From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on tensions in Ukraine plus international response. Iran nuclear talks have significant gaps. More talks in May. Teen accused of stabbing rampage at a U.S. high school also ahead key elections in Indonesia and India. Ukraine's government threatened on Wednesday to use force against pro-Russian activists who have seized a security services building in the eastern city of Luhansk. But there are also signs that the standoff might be resolved peacefully and that international tensions over Ukraine could also be eased. During a meeting with other Russian government officials on Wednesday, President Putin, Vladimir Putin, spoke about the situation in Ukraine. He said, "I'm hoping that by the initiative from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia, we can level out the situation in Ukraine." He went on to say, "and improve it, and we will see real consequences and positive results." Mr. Putin urged Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to offer initiatives that could solve the difficult situation in Ukraine. Mr. Putin added, and I quote, "At least I hope that the interim officials on various levels haven't done anything that cannot be fixed." NATO's top military commander in Europe said on Wednesday that countermoves to the Russian military threat against Ukraine could include sending American troops to alliance nations in Eastern Europe who are feeling at risk right now. NATO foreign ministers have asked General Breedlove, that's Philip Breedlove, to propose steps to reassure NATO members nearest Russia that other alliance countries have their backs. The U.S. Air Force General spoke with the Associated Press.
Essentially, what we are looking at is a package of land, air, and maritime measures that would build assurance for our easternmost allies. And we are directed to develop those land, air, and maritime packages so that it also addresses sort of the northern allies, the center allies, and the southern allies.
General Breedlove also spoke about the buildup of Russian troops near Ukraine's eastern border.
I would characterize it as a combined arms army. In other words, this is an army that has all of the provisioning and enablers that it needs to accomplish military objectives if given them. Fixed wing aircraft, rotary wing aircraft, artillery, tactical supply in some units, strategic supply in some units, field hospitals, communication, jamming gear, all of the things that it needs to accomplish any sort of objective given in Ukraine.
That is NATO's top military commander, U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, speaking Wednesday in Brussels with Associated Press. Meantime, Victoria Nuland, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, said on Wednesday that the U.S. doesn't have high expectations for any talks between the Russians, the European Union, and the United States over de-escalating the crisis in Ukraine. But it remains important, she says, to keep the diplomatic door open.
The events in Ukraine are a wake-up call for all of us. Everything we have stood for over 40 years as a community of free nations, is at risk if we allow aggressive acts to go unchecked and unpunished.
Ms. Nuland was testifying in Washington before the U.S. Helsinki Commission over the current crisis in Ukraine. Ukrainian government and the U.S. have accused Moscow of fomenting the unrest as a pretext for another Russian military incursion similar to last month's takeover of Crimea. Up to 40,000 Russian troops are amassed along the Ukrainian border, according to NATO. One of the U.S. lawmakers who sat on Wednesday's U.S. Helsinki Commission panel was Stephen Cohen, a Democratic congressman from the state of Tennessee. He had a question for Ms. Nuland about some cities in eastern Ukraine where pro-Russian demonstrators have occupied some public buildings.
Do we have any proof, not suspicion, but proof, that Russians have been involved in the takeover of the buildings?
The evidence is overwhelming that this was a very carefully orchestrated well-planned, well-targeted, well-coordinated effort to take over buildings in four cities within the same 24-hour period with identical tactics.
Ms. Doolin also recounted at least one incident in which the action did not start out according to plan, with a group in Kharkiv initially sought to take over the opera house there rather than a local government building. She said that indicated that these were not boys from Kharkiv and they were not quite as well planned and executed as they might have been. All the cities affected by the uprisings are in Ukraine's industrial heartland in the east, which has a large population of ethnic Russians, and economic and cultural ties to Russia are strong. Many residents are suspicious of the government that took power in February.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Negotiators from Iran in the so-called P5 plus one, that's the U.S., Russia, China, Britain, and France plus Germany, wrapped up a round of talks on Iran's nuclear program Wednesday in Vienna. The West believes Tehran is trying to build a nuclear weapon, a charge they deny. Henry Ridgewell reporting now, the negotiators remain a long way from reaching agreement.
This is the third time negotiators from Iran and the P5 plus one have met this year in Vienna. EU Foreign Affairs Chief Catherine Ashton, who is coordinating the talks, admitted to significant gaps between the parties.
A lot of intensive work will be required to overcome the differences which naturally still exist at this stage in the process.
All sides hope to sign a comprehensive agreement by a self-imposed July 20th deadline. Iran leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has insisted in the past Iran will never give up nuclear enrichment or shut any nuclear facility. But the United States and the European Union are demanding limits on Iran's efforts to develop more efficient enrichment technology. They want to extend the breakout period, the time it would take Iran to make a nuclear bomb, currently estimated to be 2 months. Speaking Tuesday to Congress, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned Tehran the United States will respond if Iran takes that path.
If they're overtly breaking out and breaking an agreement and starting to enrich and pursue it, they've made a huge consequential decision. And the greater likelihood is we are going to respond immediately.
In return for scaling back its nuclear program, Iran wants the West to lift sanctions that have crippled its economy. Optimism over the talks has sparked interest from many Western companies, says CEO Nigel Kushner of W Legal in London, which advises firms on trading with countries subject to sanctions.
A lot of different exporters and a lot of different industries who all wish to jump back into the Iranian market.
Aviation is set to be one of the first entrants into that market. Years of sanctions on the sale of aircraft and spare parts to Iran have left its passenger fleet decrepit. Aviation analysts say there have been dozens of incidents related to worn-out aircraft. The head of Iran Air was at the talks in Vienna to negotiate an easing of sanctions on the sale of aircraft parts. It will be a gradual process, says Nigel Kushner.
First of all, it applies mainly to Iran Air. It doesn't include a number of other Iranian airlines, for example, Mahan Air. They can't avail themselves of this opportunity. And it is limited to spare parts. They can't go out and purchase new planes.
Negotiators hope to build on the tentative agreements when they meet again May the 13th in Vienna. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Two car bombs exploded Wednesday in a government-held district of Syria's battleground city of Homs, killing at least 25 people. They're wounding more than 100 others. The blast hit a commercial street inhabited mostly by members of President Bashar al-Assad's minority Alawite sect in the central city, where government forces have been imposing a heavy siege on the rebel-controlled districts. Syria's uprising, which began with largely peaceful protest against Mr. Assad's rule back in March of 2011, has since evolved into a civil war with sectarian overtones pitting predominantly Sunni Muslim rebels against an Assad government that is dominated by Alawites, an offshoot of Shiite Islam. Well, a high-level Christian delegation from Lebanon is calling for nations to stop selling weapons to the warring factions in Syria. The prelates say these arms are used as for the war and the are impending the peace efforts there. We get the story now from Lisa Schlein.
A high-ranking delegation of Maronite prelates from Lebanon is at the United Nations in Geneva to press its case for peace in the Middle East and, in particular, for Syria. Archbishop Paul Saya, who is vicar general to the Patriarch in Lebanon, says the war in Syria will stop when everybody stops selling arms to those who are fighting. He tells VOA those who are supplying weapons have no thought for the suffering and misery endured by the civilian population. He says their interest is for political or economic gain. He says this is unacceptable.
They should stop supplying arms to everybody, and then people will come and sit together and talk peace. As long as they are fed with arms and political support and money, people will continue. It's good business for everybody. As long as Assad thinks he's going to win, he's not going to stop. If the others think they're going to win, they will never stop. But they will know once those who are supplying the arms stop supplying the arms that eventually they'll have to stop.
Archbishop Saya says the delegation, which is led by His Beatitude Cardinal Bechara, held a somewhat depressing meeting with UN envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. He says the UN mediator feels disillusioned and sees no way forward in the peace process at the moment.
It looks like he's not going to be there for very long either. I'm sure somebody else will have to pick up the problem, but start again, go back to square one. And this is waste of time. This is waste of lives.
More than 130,000 people reportedly have been killed during the past 3 years of civil war in Syria. Around 9 million have been displaced in and outside the country. Lebanon, which is a much smaller country than Syria, recently registered its 1 millionth refugee. Archbishop Saya says this huge number of refugees is placing an intolerable burden upon the political, social, and economic well-being of Lebanon. He says the refugees also are causing security concerns.
The way things are at the moment, all those people are scattered all over the place in among the population. They take the jobs of the Lebanese. You know, they are now causing a lot of security problems, you know, with kidnapping, with murder, with all sorts of violence, because those people are hungry. You know, they kidnap somebody and they ask for money. Why? Because, you know, simply they're hungry. I'm not condoning, you know, but that's the situation.
The Archbishop says he and his fellow prelates support the Lebanese government's proposition that refugee camps for Syrians should be established either in safe areas inside Syria or in the no man's land between Syria and Lebanon. Under this plan, he says the United Nations would provide security for the camps and the UN Refugee Agency and other humanitarian organizations would provide relief supplies to the refugees. He says the delegation has discussed this proposal with the UN director and other officials in Geneva, but as of now, he says, the delegation has not received a definite response as to whether the United Nations will or will not subscribe to this plan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Student armed with a knife went on a stabbing and slashing spree in a U.S. high school near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on Wednesday, leaving at least 20 people injured, including 4 students who suffered serious wounds. The suspect, a male student, was taken into custody, being questioned now by police. Incident happened after most students had arrived at Franklin Regional High School in Murraysville, but before the school day officially was in session. Initial reports indicated the stabbings happened during a fire drill, but investigators now believe another student may have pulled a fire alarm to alert others to the emergency in hopes that that would clear the building. Thomas Seifeld is Murraysville's police chief.
In a situation like this, you want the students to run. You know, going back to the fire alarm being pulled, I mean, that's the purpose, is to evacuate. You want the kids to get out of the area. And they did, and they did right. That's what they should have done.
Police are saying it's not immediately clear why the attacks took place, and doctors are saying all the stabbing victims are expected to survive. Just days before the first anniversary of the deadly Boston Marathon bombing attacks here in the U.S., a congressional panel invited several Boston-area law enforcement officials to reflect on their response and to discuss ways for other communities to prepare for potential tragedies. VOA's Cindy Sain reports that Democratic and Republican lawmakers were united in praising Boston's response to the unexpected events that unfolded a year ago.
House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul had emotional praise for the neighboring Boston and Watertown police departments. The Boston area was the scene of days of dramatic events after the marathon bombing, as brothers Tamerlan and Jokhar Tsarnaev engaged in a deadly gun battle with police, which resulted in the death of Tamerlan and a prolonged manhunt for Jokhar. During a hearing Wednesday, McCaul pointed out the brothers had allegedly planned to go to New York City next.
These terrorists had six more bombs in their car, and they were on their way to Times Square. If it wasn't for these heroic acts of bravery, New York City could have been hit again.
Democratic Representative Loretta Sanchez pointed out that there is an ongoing investigation and urged caution at the hearing not to interfere with the prosecution of Jokhar, who will go on trial November 3rd, facing the death penalty.
You know, Attorney General Holder's decision to seek the death penalty is a game changer.
Former Boston Police Commissioner Edward Davis said the people of Boston are still united in the feeling of Boston strong, and many are preparing to run in this year's marathon to honor those who died last year.
And we run for the men and women and children who can't be there this year. Crystal Campbell, Lou Lindsay, Martin Richard, and Officer Sean Collier.
Watertown Police Chief Edward DeVoe said he is entering the race.
This year I will run with 12 of my officers. It's going to be an emotional day for my officers as we run that route and cross the finish line on Boylston Street.
Several lawmakers said that local law enforcement plays a crucial role in responding to terrorist and other attacks, and federal agents should share information with them. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
People across 14 Indian states Wednesday cast their ballots for another day of polling in the nine-phase national election. Parliamentary voting is being held over several weeks for logistical and safety reasons. In New Delhi, more than 12 million people are eligible to vote, with a total of 150 candidates. Ravi Kant is a software professional who spoke about the voting.
I feel that definitely the new government is going to bring effective administration changes. And also I would like to say that this is required because trends change every 5 years.
The main Hindu opposition, with strong momentum on promises of a surge in economic growth, appears to be leading the race over the Congress Party, which has been in power now for 10 years. Nearly 50,000 security personnel, mobile police squads, and video surveillance teams are being deployed in the capital to help ensure peaceful polling in Delhi. Multi-phase voting across the country runs until May 12th, with results of the 543-seat lower house of parliament announced on May 16th. And in Indonesia, voting in the country's legislative elections has ended. The results will set the stage for the world's third-largest democracy's presidential balloting in July, likely to be won by popular opposition Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, also known as Jokowi. The one-day vote was open to nearly 187 million eligible voters, about one-third of them under the age of 30, who chose from some 200,000 candidates for nearly 20,000 national, provincial, and local seats. Sydney Jones, head of the Jakarta-based Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict, tells my colleague Victor Beatty the election involving voters in more than 17,000 islands in three time zones was a massive undertaking in the world's largest Muslim nation.
The voting was going pretty smoothly throughout the country. There were a couple of places where voting materials didn't get to the voting places in time, especially in one of the more remote parts of Papua. So that election will be delayed for 1 or 2 days. But it's basically gone quite smoothly, and everybody was lining up to do their civic duty.
How important is this vote?
It's very important as an expression of consolidating Indonesia's democracy. Indonesia has been one of the most successful countries that's made the transition from authoritarianism to democracy. But if you look at Thailand, for example, even when things seem to be going well for a few years, they suddenly reverse themselves, and now Thailand is in a political mess. Indonesia, it's been a steady strengthening of the democratic process over the years, and I think Indonesians should be very proud of that.
Well, the election today was relatively peaceful. Does it encourage you with regard to Indonesia's up-and-coming democracy?
Yes, very much so. The one area that hasn't been peaceful is Aceh, on the northern tip of Sumatra, where we had a peace agreement in 2005 that basically ended a three-decade-old insurgency. And there are a number of reasons that make Aceh special, but that's the one area that we've had very serious violence and where the former rebels are in control of the government at both the legislative and executive levels. But much of the violence has to do with internal dissension within the rebel movement itself. With that exception, I think Indonesia is going to move forward on a steady basis. I think the biggest problem that they are going to have to face is the really endemic corruption that both inhibits economic growth and tarnishes the democracy that it's done so well to sustain.
Sydney Jones is head of the Jakarta-based Institute for Policy Analysis and Conflict. She was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Indonesia is still considered a young democracy after emerging from more than three decades of rule by dictator Suharto, which ended in 1998. Incumbent President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono of the ruling Democratic Party is barred from seeking a third term. Australian chief of the search team looking for the missing Malaysian jet is voicing optimism that the plane could be found soon, maybe. Angus Houston said Wednesday that two signals detected a day earlier by a U.S. Navy Pinger locator gave researchers, some reason to hope that they will find that wreckage of the jet.
We have no idea at this stage what is under the water. And, of course, as soon as we finish the towed pinger locator work, and hopefully we'll get some more transmissions to better refine the point on the ocean floor where the transmissions are emanating from, once we've got that, and there's probably no more hope of picking up any more transmissions, we will put the autonomous underwater vehicle down to have a look.
Houston also said that the most recent signals will help to reduce the search area west of Australia to a much more manageable region, as he put it. But he added the searchers need to visually identify aircraft wreckage before they can confirm that Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 crashed there. The Boeing 777 disappeared back on March 8th. It was on a planned flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. It had 239 people aboard. One last item today, a glitch in internet security from software meant to encrypt and protect online transactions has potentially exposed millions of passwords as well as credit card numbers and other sensitive bits of information to potential theft by computer hackers. Security researchers reveal that breakdown known as Heartbleed this week. The glitch was in a vulnerable version of software which is called OpenSSL. It is a particular concern because it went undetected for more than 2 years. The bug involves the technology meant to protect online accounts for emails, instant messaging, and a wide range of electronic commerce. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Very good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On April 10, 1815, the biggest volcanic eruption in history occurred at Mount Tambora in southern Indonesia. More than 90,000 people were killed. Volcanic ash from the eruption caused widespread crop failure. Global temperatures dropped an average of 3 degrees Celsius, and Europe experienced what was known as the year without summer. On this date in 1829, English Methodist clergyman William Booth was born. Booth helped organize the Salvation Army, one of the largest religious and humanitarian aid organizations in the world. Also born on this day in 1847 was Joseph Pulitzer. The Hungarian immigrant to America took up newspaper reporting as a young man, eventually becoming a powerful newspaper publisher. In his will, he established the Pulitzer Prizes that continue to recognize excellence in journalism. In 1872, at the urging of newspaper man and future agriculture secretary J. Sterling Morton, more than a million trees were planted on what would become the first American Arbor Day. Similar celebrations are observed around the world. In 1925, American writer F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic, The Great Gatsby, was first published. The book explores the societal decadence rampant during the period of U.S. history known as the Roaring Twenties. On this day in 1970, a promotional self-interview by Paul McCartney was seized upon by the media as an official announcement that the iconic rock band The Beatles had broken up. Promoting a new solo album, McCartney didn't specifically say that the Beatles had split up, but strongly hinted at it when he said his days as a songwriting collaborator with fellow Beatle John Lennon had ended. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Recent provocative actions by North Korea, also known as the DPRK, serve as yet another reminder of the threat posed by the DPRK's nuclear, ballistic missile, and proliferation programs. On March 26th, North Korea launched two medium-range ballistic missiles in direct violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions prohibiting such launches. The Security Council condemned the DPRK's launches March 28th as a clear violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions and agreed to consult on an appropriate Council response. The DPRK, on March 30th, announced that it would conduct additional launches and, possibly, a new type of nuclear test. On March 31st, North Korea fired hundreds of artillery shells, including across the northern limit line in the Yellow Sea, during a live fire exercise. Close to 100 landed in South Korean waters. South Korea responded by returning fire into North Korean waters. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf called the DPRK's artillery barrage a deliberate decision to further escalate tensions.
This provocative barrage follows a number of short-range and medium-range ballistic missile launches, threats to conduct a nuclear test, and other provocative statements that we've seen over the past several weeks. Once again, call on the DPRK to cease and desist from needlessly threatening regional peace and security, and would note that these kind of provocations only strengthen the resolve of the international community and deepen Pyongyang's isolation.
Ms. Harf stressed that North Korea's leaders face a choice. They can choose to further escalate, or they can choose to come in line with their international obligations and rejoin the international community. Unfortunately, what we've seen recently is the former. U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, who was on a 10-day trip to the Asia-Pacific that includes a visit to China, said at a press briefing that he would raise the subject of North Korea with his Chinese counterpart. "The North Koreans have to stop these provocative actions," said Mr. Hagel. "We have been very clear on that."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.